buying a home? Don't panic. Just listen to the rest of this podcast.
Report writing is the real challenge, I think, that most people that are inspectors really have problems with, because you can have all the technical expertise in the world, but if you can't communicate it to somebody that has no idea what you're talking about and make them understand it enough to be able to make a purchasing no-go-go decision, that's your job.
That is the job, to filter out the
techno speak and make it so someone understands the implications and that they can make a decision.
Yeah. So, anyway, you know, what I wanted to say next would be, you know, like the report writing is, you know, you just spent 2, 3, 4 hours on someone's house, depending how big it was. And you're gathering all this, you're there to collect information. You know, now you have to follow your standards, inspect what's in your standards, you know, report on it. And now you got to go home and create your Mona Lisa. You know, you need to go home and really like send this thing home. This is what you're being paid for right here. This is the end game right here. So if you mess this up, you're going to get a lot of phone calls, like Skip mentioned already. So if you find yourself still getting a lot of phone calls and it's always about the same thing, well, then you want to open up your report writing software, look at your canned response and rethink it. And kind of use what your customers are saying to you and what they're asking. And that's going to shed some light on it, because that still happens to me to this day. You know, I'm 10 years in on this, doing home inspection, 10 years in now. And like you, Skip, I don't get too many phone calls when it comes to trying to understand the report.
Anybody that says they don't make changes to their report software, I think, is a candidate for litigation. I still, to this day, write and modify comments, and, you know, and the scary part is I have some comment that I, you know, for the last 10 years I've been using something like it and I find a typo. It's just, that drives me nuts. I mean, I try, I spell check and grammar check, and my wife looks at it. It's like,
all right.
And my wife is not technical. I use her simply because she's the client. She's like the filter. And if she doesn't understand it, then she says, this doesn't make any sense to me.
I can't remember who it was, but I remember an inspector telling me years ago, he said he put in the heading of his report, there will be typos in my report, so deal with it. basically,
I've seen language to that effect.
I agree. I looked at him like, look, if you're saying that because you just don't give a shit, that's one thing. But if you're saying that because you don't know how to write, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the reality is spell check doesn't work on a lot of what we do.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, it doesn't know what some of these words are. You know, what's a weep? What's a weep screed?
Right.
You know, so it's like there is no spell check for this book. I mean, there is, you know, for the basic words, yeah. But if I was proofreading code check combo 10th today, and Douglas has been through it. He's like lived and breathed this, the book, for months. Redwood's looked at it. Another guy, Glenn Matheson, who writes tech books for ICC, he's looked at it. We've had a professional editor look at it, and I'm finding typos. Yeah. And when I'm done with it, I guarantee you there will still be typos in it. We call them, I'm trying to look for it. They're called, let's see if that'll actually focus. They're called errata.
Right.
So, for every one of our books, we put together an errata sheet, and the errata is a nice way of saying we made a mistake and here's a list. And that list has got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 items on it. That's updated in August of this year, and it's Code Check Complete 3rd edition. That's a book that just came out, and it's got 350 pages, and I'd almost guarantee you there's more typos that we don't know about. So it and it's not for lack of trying. It's just the complexity of the documents is so high on inspection reports and these books that and they're so technical in nature by design that that you've got to be really on your game.
I know you're involved in the NHIE study group. I've actually I've actually been trying to download those and catch up with what you've been doing.
Well, I'm actually not, to be clear, I'm not in the Korea NHIE study prep class.
Okay.
Because I can't. I'm actually the people that write test questions for NHIE, the National Home Inspector Exam, are called subject matter experts. I'm an SME, so I actually write test questions and edit the test. So I'm not allowed to teach a class on test prep.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So I've been involved in NHIE for about 10 years, and it's a blast. I mean, we sit in a room, and there's, you know, there's 15 to 25 people, and these are all like really top-notch people, but they're also part of the NHIE test prep, test construction requires that we have people that are new inspectors. So we want people that have just taken the test and passed, as well as people that are old and gray and broken down like me, because we want that mix. And back to your point, you know, clients ask you questions about reports and you've never really looked at it from that perspective. The same thing happens with the new guys that have just taken the test. And it's like, you know, I didn't get that, you know, the questions related to that I didn't pass, and because I didn't understand. And so it helps us put the test in language that is easier for people to understand. Because the intent of the NHIE, I see comments all the time online where there's test questions or trick questions, or they're asking all this irrelevant stuff, and the reality is, there are certainly bad questions in the NHIE. There's no intentionally trick questions. As a matter of fact, we're not allowed to write questions that way. There's these professional test construction design people called psychometricians, and they're in the room and they write hurt over us.
Psychometricians.
And the guys that NHIE uses, they do college entrance prep exams. They're like the same company that does the ACT exam.
Right.
So serious money. I mean, these guys are really, really bright.
Well, I remember taking it. I remember taking the NHIE about, I think it was probably about 8-9 years ago. And I didn't pass my first time. I think I was off by like 3 or 4 points.
Yep.
And then I had to go back and did it again. And I was like over, like I passed the, you know, the minimum requirement by like 5 points. I've never been good at tests my whole life.
And the thing is, most people aren't. They're scared of them. And the thing I always tell people is, they're, you know, no one's trying to make you fail. But the kind of an embarrassing point is when I took the initial Korea exam, it was not the NHIE. It was actually a Korea real exam. It was their own exam, and they switched to NHIE not because of any other reason than it was so expensive to maintain a psychometrically valid exam that it was cheaper to just use the NHIE. I mean, I took it, the Korea exam, before there was a National Home Inspector exam. And at that point, ASHI and Korea had reciprocity. So if you passed the Korea exam, you could become an ASHI member without taking the ASHI exam, which was not NHIE. It was pre that. and vice versa. So an ASHI member could become a CREA. We looked at each other's tests as equivalent. So for years, I was an SME on the NHIE, and I'd never taken the exam. End of last year, they finally said, look, you've got to take the exam. And so I got the books, I read the books, and I took the exam, and I passed, and I was sweating bullets because it would have been so embarrassing to not pass that exam the first time.
yeah. A lot of pressure there. I took the exam to get my CREA certification. That's why I took the exam. Mm-hmm. Did I learn anything from that exam? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I didn't learn anything from that exam. I didn't learn a thing from that exam that helped me with my home inspection career.
Well,
what was in that quiz? The basic stuff was just simple, common sense construction stuff that I already knew because I had a construction background. So that was easy. So I'm not saying it was a waste of time. I'm just saying it was, I didn't take anything away from that after I took it.
Well, here's the rationale behind the test. It's what's considered to be a high stakes exam. So there's 35 states that use that for licensure. So it has to filter out people that don't know the baseline information. Mm-hmm. And if the fact that you passed meant you knew the baseline information, the idea is, and what they drill into our heads, matter of fact, every one of the SME sessions starts out the same way. They run us through why you're here and what the goal is. So NHIE is not an SOP exam. It is not based on ASHI. It's not based on CREA. It's not based on InterNACHI. It's not based on pick an organization. It is an exam based on what inspectors do in the field. And every 5 years, there's what's called a role delineation study. And if you remember back about a year or so ago, you got probably a questionnaire in the email, and it took about 30 minutes if you actually filled it out to go through, and it would ask you questions like, in the course of an inspection, do you do this? Sometimes, always, never, not applicable, whatever. And it runs through that. That questionnaire generates the content outline for the NHIE. So if 95% of the inspectors always put in how many amps is the electrical panel, the main service, then that's going to be on the test. And that's an item that's got to be included in the test. And if you look at the content outline, if you go to the NHIE website and you look, there's a study guide, and it'll say 30% of the stuff in under electrical is going to be panels and services, and 20% is going to be on wiring. Those percentages and the percentages breakdown amongst these high level silos are all based on that role delineation study. So there's been some problems with that. The first time I was on a RDS committee for NHIE. I know it's a lot of like gibberish kind of stuff, acronyms. We were sitting in New York, and the previous RDS had asked a question about pools. And the way that question was worded was actually pretty poorly done. And so it generated a response that forced pool questions to be included, because we can't edit those responses. If people say 100% of the time, I look at pools, and that's not what happened, but then pools are going in the exam. That simple. And so they asked a question that elicited a response that was erroneous. And for the next 5 years, there's questions on something and everybody's going, I don't do this. Why am I getting asked questions on it? So we had to fix that. And the same things happen on some other stuff too. So the process is kind of iterative, and we've narrowed it down to where this last time there were really very few content outline high level changes that got made. There were a few. The point being is the test is constructed in a way. One of the psychometricians explains it this way. He said, if you get in an airplane and you're sitting in the back, there's a pilot and a co-pilot up front. The co-pilot and the pilot, this could be their first flight, and they have just passed their FAA exams, and you know, this is their first time going up in the air. So they are not the same as the people in the back. They've met the baseline to be able to fly that airplane. So their level of knowledge is way higher than the people in the back of the plane, assuming there's no pilots back there. But their level of experience is relatively low compared to other pilots.
Sure.
The same thing is true of a home inspector going out for their first paid inspection. Mm-hmm. They know way more than they think they know. They know way more than their clients as a rule, and certainly the agents in general. But they may not know anywhere near as much as other inspectors that are working in their market, because they don't have the flight hours that those senior pilots have.
Right.
So that's the kind of the methodology, the rule we operate under when we do NHIE stuff is that those test questions have to be written to filter out people that do not know the baseline information. Hmm. And the rule is that somebody that passes the test should not be, through ignorance, able to do harm to the public or the profession. So we want, you know, we don't want them to miss some big hanging safety issue. Hmm. Or an issue that would cause financial harm to the clients. There's a big difference, as you pointed out, rightfully so, between somebody that has just taken that test and somebody that has 5,000 or 10,000 inspections under their belt. Hopefully, there should be a big difference between them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's my NHIE spiel. I think it's worthwhile.
Yeah.
Endeavor.
Sure.
But it's really a filtering mechanism. The questions are written, and this gets drilled into our heads when we're writing test questions. The answer should be obvious to anybody that knows the source material. There should be only one right answer, and the distractors, the other, you know, if there's four alternatives, one of those is a right answer. The other three are considered distractors. The distractors have to be plausible to somebody that doesn't know the source material, right, and is guessing.
So let me give you my opinion on the whole training in the NHIE versus actual on the job experience. To me, like I said, if you've never been around this type of a, you know, if you were born in a house, but you don't know how a house works, that's understandable. That's most of the population. In my eyes, you know, a lot of people just don't understand how houses function and how to avoid problems. That's just because they didn't teach us that in school. You know, that should be, hey, you know what? Why are we going to school? Well, I'm going to back up a little bit. Why do we go to school? Well, to get an education. Okay. What's that going to teach us? Probably get a job. Good paying job. And then what do we do with that money? Well, we buy a house. So why didn't they teach us about the house in school? You know, this, I think some things got skipped. And I always say that it's like, having a driver's license does not mean you know how to drive a car. It just means you passed a minimum requirement test to get that license. That's a fact. There's a lot of horrible drivers that have licenses. So anyway, what my point is, what comes first, the cart or the horse? So to me, if someone was going to ask me for advice today, John, what do I do? Do I just go inspect as many houses as I can following my standards and get that experience under my belt? Or do I waste money going into an online school or something like that? Or, you know, what do I do first? What would you say? What I would say is to, like I said, call all your friends, all your relatives, volunteer to inspect their houses using your standards, get as much hands-on and to actually get the experience of what a house looks like when people live in it. Because you got to find stuff. Stuff's going to be blocked. There's so many obstacles when you're actually dealing with a home that somebody lives in, as opposed to taking a course and looking at photos of nice, clean panels. When you get there, it's falling apart. There's cobwebs everywhere. You can't see anything. You know, there's just so much to it. So when it comes to the option of, you know, getting your certifications, I don't think it's a bad thing, but understand that's not what's getting you hired. I see a lot of guys make that mistake. They just think that's going to get them a job because they took a certification class. That's not how it works.
Well, most people don't get, they aren't comfortable with the sales and marketing part of inspecting. If you're going to be a sole proprietor, which I did, I looked at it, and there are some markets, like in San Diego, you almost don't get hired unless you're a CREA inspector, from what I understand. I think that's changed a little bit, but there's some markets where the realtors understand the differences. Around
where's,
here,
where's they, this? Where'd you say that was?
San Diego. It used to be, if you weren't a CREA inspector, you basically couldn't get a job, an inspection job.
Down no there. Kidding.
I think that's changed a little bit.
I think so too, because I know a lot of guys who are not CREA inspectors that are down there.
Yeah. And that's not the way it used to be 15 years ago. Around here, I think, it's less than what I would like it to be, but I think the agents do look, for credentials, because most of them actually realize that we're not licensed now. And I still have an occasional newbie that will say, oh yeah, and Skip's license. It's like, well, yeah, I've got a driver's license, but that's the only one I've got.
That's what I tell them too.
I think the credentials have value. I looked at it when I first started. I did this. I looked around and said, okay, so who are the really good inspectors in my market? And then I went, okay, so what organizations do they belong to? And they were all ASHI and CREA guys. So I figured, okay, so that's what I'm going to do. And what I did in that process, though, was I did just a hellacious amount of education. When I first started out, I didn't do any inspections until I got my CCI. And the reason was I looked at it like, do you really want to get in a cab with somebody that's got a learner's permit? Or do you want somebody that's got kind of a full real driver's license? So I did go the credential route, but one of the things I did was, I went to, we've got, at that time we had three, ASHI and CREA chapters in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. I would go every month to all three of them. And every time somebody had a toolbox, which are weekend, usually Saturday, 6 to 8 hour deals, I would go to those. I've still got.
Yeah, I like going to the toolboxes. Some of those are pretty good. I've been to some good ones.
This was a book I got.
I was going to ask you about that.
Toolbox. It was a toolbox that I went to that Jerry McCarthy taught before, up in Sacramento. And you went up there and he spent 8 hours going through the 1997 UBC, which was what California adopted as the 2001 California Building Code. And we highlighted and tabbed the book. One of the most useful things I ever did, because it went through like guardrail heights and stairs and smoke alarm locations and all that kind of stuff. But that was one of my first toolboxes. Probably was more important than any other thing I did I mean, I'd already gone through at that time ITA, Inspection Training Associates, which is now defunct. It got sold to Kaplan, and Kaplan ran it into the ground. But my instructors were Kevin O'Malley and Mike Casey. Mike actually almost had hair at that point. and Kevin was still doing serious education. And so I learned a lot from that. But I learned enough to know that I didn't know a lot. And I did what you recommended. I went and I inspected every house for every person I could beg, borrow, or steal from. And even then, once I got started and kind of had my insurance and whatnot, I took a couple of inspections where I actually didn't feel comfortable doing the house. So what I did is I called somebody that I knew. The first one, I think, was actually Jim Keppel, who is now retired, but he was over in the East Bay. And I told him, I said, I will give you this inspection, because it was in his neighborhood, if you let me shadow you. And if you review my report and you let me review yours when we're done.
Wow.
And so I did that for a couple, three inspections until I felt like, okay, I can do this and probably not screw it up to the point where I get sued. Right. And that's when I started doing them on my own.
There you go.
That's a little different path than you, but I'm with you. I you can't
whatever works for you. Class. You know, whatever yeah. works for you. Some people
take a class and just go and inspect.
No, you can't.
You can, but I think that's a recipe for
a lot of phone calls
from people.
More phone calls
and maybe letters from people with things like JD after their name.
Yeah, exactly.